Welcome to the first episode of PedPod by ExpedLab. My name is Zareka Oropilia, and in this episode, we have Professor Dr. Arian Walls, recorded in Hotel Finsa 1222 last year in 2023.
Hi, Arian. It's so nice that you can join us here on this snowy day in Finsa, Norway.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Thank you. This is our first episode of PedPod by ExpedLab podcast. And we're very honored that you're our first guest.
Hopefully I will live up to that.
I'm sure. I'm so sure that our listeners will be able to appreciate our conversation today. But before we start with the questions, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself. Who are you?
Well, I'm Arian Walls from the Netherlands. I was born in Amsterdam a long time ago, 1964. Both my parents were environmental educators. So at a young age, we already got the pleasure of going outdoors a lot and to nature, which is not so easy in the Netherlands, a very urbanized country. But my parents also were very much connected to the environmental movement. And I think in my youth, I also developed a kind of concern about the future of the Earth. And when I decided to study, I decided to study environmental engineering at the Wageningen University, which was more the technical side to environmental problem solving, you could say, whereas my parents were more on the social side of environmental problem solving. But I must say that after maybe 1 or 2 years of more the natural science perspective on environmental problems, I started realizing that the major problems we were facing were not so much between the North and the South Pole, but between our ears in the way we live, our lifestyles and the values that we live by. So I ended up going into education, much to the delight of my parents, I think. So environmental education, sustainability education, from the very early years until death, you might say, all ages, is my field. And I've been working at Wageningen University as a professor. I also work at NMBU part-time and also at Western Norway University of Applied Sciences. So I've been around. I got my PhD at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, working in inner city Detroit schools with African-American people living under difficult circumstances. And I'm a UNESCO chair. So there's a lot to say, but I'm a father also, 2 children, Brian and Kendra, who are in their 20s, late 20s already. And I'm married to Anne, who's from the United States, originally from Wisconsin, and who considers herself a political refugee by now, because she prefers to be in the Netherlands at the moment and not so much in the United States, for reasons that I won't get into.
No. But that's a very impressive life journey, if you will. It's really admirable that you've been through a lot of different transitions into the field of sustainable education, and it's very interesting also your work on transformative learning and how it actually could be applied in real life situations, because it's something to do theoretical work but also something to impact practices, and I think that's something that it's more important, right?
Yes. Yeah, I think you mentioned transformative learning. I think transformation in yourself and in the world around you is what is needed in today's world. I think we must acknowledge that the Earth is not in a very good state at the moment. Some people call it the Anthropocene, an era, a geological epoch, where one single species, Homo sapiens, has in a way impacted systems that have formed over 4.5 billion years in only a few hundred years, which is remarkable that one single species can do that. But it's leading to the climate crisis, biodiversity collapse, And in addition to that, it has social consequences, extreme wealth inequality, lots of migration, people not being able to live where they want to live, having to move, and then people not being happy about people coming from other places. So lots of tension in the world. So we live at a critical moment in time. And we need to learn to live more lightly on the earth and more healthily and more equitably. And that means also to transform some of the structures and systems that we have created that kind of breathe unsustainability and not sustainability.
That's true. So this concept of transformation, a lot of people in the research also in the field of sustainable education now talk about pedagogical innovation or pedagogical innovations, if you will, because I believe that it should always be plural because it's a lot of different perspectives. But what constitutes pedagogical innovations? What does it mean, really? It's a lot of different understandings. And this podcast is particularly coming from the field of early childhood education and care. So maybe you could shed light on this concept.
Yes, I think, well, first of all, I think it's very, I'm very happy to notice that people are talking about pedagogy again, because there has been a moment in time, certainly in the Netherlands and in the Anglo-Saxon world as well, where pedagogy has been kind of substituted by learning and instruction. And pedagogy is so much more than that. So a lot of our education in some ways has been didacticized. Not sure if that's a word. But a lot of attention to how can we transfer ideas, knowledge, understanding upon others, and how can we create environments where people develop cognitively and in a quick way and in an efficient way, so that they become better prepared for the globalizing economy, the world of work. And pedagogy and Bildung are, I think they're closely knitted together, is much more about creating spaces that invite people's curiosity, people's passions, people's empathy, people's sense of belonging, connecting, which I think are all very important qualities for a sustainable world. And they've gradually been replaced by taking care just of yourself and maybe your own family, your own stuff, collecting many things, kind of a consumerist mindset that even in the very early years is being cultivated. So from a sustainability perspective, I look at pedagogical innovation as a regenerating of earlier pedagogies that have been around for a long time that were not at all focusing on the economy, but on much more on what you might call subjectification, as Gert Pista, a colleague from the Netherlands, calls it, which has to do with, you know, allowing children to become who they want to be, who they are, in tune with themselves, with their own bodies, nurturing a caring attitude, an ethic of care, which is so foundational for I think, all we do. If we lack that, then we could easily digress into kind of a rat race to the abyss, which is, I'm afraid to say, often the case, even in our schools, and sometimes even in early childhood settings, you know, in like Head Start programs in the United States. I recall when I was a PhD student there a long time ago, there were lots of places where, which was privatized often, where people paid a lot of money to get their children at a very young age to prepare for Harvard in a way. And that's taking all the joy, all the pleasure out of the child, but also out of learning. So innovation pedagogical innovation is it's not necessarily going to to find some kind of magic wand that will solve all these problems. I think it's more about a resetting and a refreshing, but also a rediscovering of ways that are providing opportunities for young people to see the world as it unfolds holistically, in a connected, relational way, rather than introducing them in a world that is reduced to categories, to subjects, to where people are labeled all the time, where we are very good at making distinctions, but we're terrible at making connections. And I think young children have an innate ability to see those connections, but as they get older and they go to school, they lose that ability. So that also is a kind of innovation, pedagogical innovation, also requires looking inwardly as pedagogues and educators. Where are we ourselves in this? So critical self-reflection is also needed. What am I strengthening in the way I operate and the way I connect with others and the world? And what am I silencing and forgetting and weakening? So this is beginning to, for me, this is, and I'm not so sure about the term innovation, because I think innovation has also destroyed much of what we have.
Yeah.
I think many of our sustainability problems are a result of continuous innovation.
You have talked about this before in another podcast, actually, with the Western Arabia University of Applied Sciences, about this concept of innovation in light of many innovations. So can you, maybe you can...
Yeah, that was meant a bit provocatively to say, you know, we need to innovate, and that really refers to, rather than always wanting to renew and to develop as something that keeps us going, we need to also learn to slow down, to pause, to enjoy the winter in a way.
Yeah.
Which, you know, the snow is coming down behind us. The nature is kind of contracting in a way, and it's replenishing for the spring. And there's decay and decomposition and maybe even death. But that's part of the cycle of life. And in our economic thinking, there's no room for that.
Yeah.
It must always develop, renew, and we must be more clever than the next company or organization in getting a grant or getting more market share, and expand profit, things like that. So there's this restlessness, and if we don't do that, we fall behind. So this is this rat race I was talking about. So if innovation drives everything, then it can do more harm than good. So innovation was really meant to say, let's find some kind of balance. We need to also pause and conserve things. You know, conservation is also important. I sometimes say sustainability, when we talk about sustainable development, it's important that we ask, what is worth sustaining, which has to do with the good things that we have around us, that we should keep and maintain and not innovate. No, let them be.
Yeah, you talk about this regenerating and revisiting practices, maybe as part of innovation, that we look back to the past and we gain wisdom from the wisdom of the past, actually. So I was thinking, you know how there are a lot of different projects right now about intergenerational relations and how we have to strengthen intergenerational relations once again, or other projects that actually strengthen relations amongst different actors. And that's what we try to do in XPED Lab also, is to work better as in a team with different actors for the field of early childhood through workshops, for example. So we see that also as pedagogical innovations. Is this something?
Well, that is the kind of the way of working, and not so much expert-driven and policy-driven, but much more this idea of co-creation and Yeah, building trust between people, because there's a lot of distrust in our current culture of managerialism, accountability, testing, measurement, where there's a lack of trust in a way between people, and it doesn't lead to the social cohesion that you need if you want to create a culture or a community of learners where people are happy. And I think intergenerational learning, if we talk about innovation, that could be an innovation to turn the gaze, to turn the lens more to a reciprocal process where it's not just the adults kind of, you know, the children learning from the adults.
That's right.
And the wisdom the adults supposedly have.
Because that's right.
If we look at the older generations in our society and the kind of earth they're leaving behind, you can hardly say that that's a wise use of the world and the earth. So that's romanticizing in a way the older generation, which is not to say that there is still a lot of wisdom around us in the older generation, and not also in indigenous communities. A lot of local knowledge about place that is very valuable and meaningful. But at the same time, there's also the wisdom of the children, I think, that adults can learn from, and the playfulness of children, their curiosity, their way of interacting together. And in some ways, and this could be an innovation, if you will, this notion of interspecies learning, where we not just learn between humans,
yeah,
but there's also something happening between humans and other species. And I think that's very important to acknowledge that here we're in Norway, where I think we're not far, we're in Finse, at 1,222 meters above sea level, and it's snowing, and we're very close to the cabin of Arne Næss, famous Norwegian philosopher, who coined the term deep ecology.
Yes.
And he had this in his work, he kind of refers to this relational aspect of connecting with nature, being in nature, and deriving meaning from the interaction with immersing yourself in a place. And that could be strengthened, I think, also in all education, but also in early childhood education.
Thank you. You've talked about a lot of the different conditions to having pedagogical innovations, but I wonder about hindering factors. What could be factors or conditions that would hinder pedagogical innovations the way you talked about it?
Yeah. You know, I think we must acknowledge that, say, the drive to sustain is not as great as the drive to consume. It's not an even battlefield, you could say, although I don't like the term battlefield, but it's not a level playing field. We talk about this in a world where we're continuously nudged to consume, to compete, to excel. And that is not very conducive for this kind of paradigm shift. So, and this is where transgressive learning comes in, and disruptive capacity building, because we tend to talk about what can we do in schools and how can we make sure that children become, you know, have agency and have these qualities like empathy and changing perspectives and opening up to diversity, dealing with uncertainty, anxiety about the future, creating hope. These are very important stories, and it's very important that our schools engage in that. But we're having these conversations in a world where, well, measurement, testing, ranking, accountability is still very strong. So we need to also not just focus on the children and on the, but also on the structures and the systems that in a way hold us hostage, that make it very difficult to enact these stories about pedagogy that we are telling ourselves, maybe in a bubble, hopefully not. But so how do we disrupt these systems that normalize unsustainability, that normalize competition, that normalize individualism, that normalize extractivism, that normalize that everything becomes a commodity that can be traded in transactions, where everything is a transaction, where even young people are input, throughput, output, and or clients, like universities, our students are our clients. That kind of language is the language that strips humanity from the essence of what it means to be human. So we need to be aware of that, that we are doing this in a world that is that kind of pushes in another direction. So we need to go against the grain. And this counter-hegemonic effort is really needed. And it takes guts and a little bit of activism, becoming a bit more radical. I almost want to say more angry.
Or maybe brave.
Or brave.
We have to be courageous, because it seems like what I'm hearing is it also entails good governance. And this it takes guts to also speak up about these issues, because if it's going to be systemic, then it also has to have systemic solutions.
Yeah.
And we need relationality, if you will, to be able to solve
wicked
problems.
Fortunately, you know, we do see practices where this more relational pedagogy is being enacted. More maybe in the Nordic context, there's more room for this and maybe more policy support for this. But I think these practices speak for themselves, where the whole child is in a whole kindergarten, in a whole community that is nurturing this kind of building approach, where children are happier, more in tune with themselves, with their local environment, with the outdoors. And are beginning to think about living more lightly, more circular, trying to reuse materials, sharing materials, so enacting the circular economy in the kindergarten. Also thinking more about food, what do we eat, what do we want to eat, what makes us feel happy. That has consequences. Can we work with the local farmers? How can we do that? Thinking more about the water we use, the plants around us, making schoolyards greener. This is happening in many places, and these practices, in a way, speak for themselves. You don't need a test to measure that these practices have high impact. You just need to visit, and that's enough.
Yeah.
And that's we're also obsessed by proving that something is working. And it only counts if we can measure it. We need to also move away from that. So there needs to be some innovation in assessment, where we're looking for signs that indicate empathy, deeper connections. And that's not always measurable. In fact, as soon as you try to measure it, you kill it in a way. And so we need to be very critical of that too, and find alternative ways. Maybe assessment isn't even the right word.
Exactly. And I'm now thinking that we have a lot to learn from indigenous communities and how they live and how they used to live, that maybe their practices have changed also nowadays. But what has been done in the past is something that has to be revisited. So there's a lot of wisdom that we have to, as you said, regenerate and revisit in the light of pedagogical innovations. It's not always about moving forward. It's also sometimes moving back and reflecting critically on what are we doing? Why is society the way it is right now? What can be learned from indigenous wisdom? And as you said, there are already practices that are actually admirable in terms of sustainability education, and it's something that uplifts pedagogical innovation also. But how come we're moving away from that?
Yeah, I think, you know, now we get also into colonization and decolonization, and in some ways the Anthropocene is not a good qualifier, I think, because it suggests that all humans are responsible for the state of the earth, and that's not true. It's certain humans, and within, you might even say, it's not even the humans, it's the system of, I would say, capitalism that has been created, that in some ways science has become a part of this, because science too is very much looking at how can we engineer the world in a way and shape it and make it in a way that we can optimize processes and kind of maximize predictability and minimize uncertainty. There's a particular way of thinking that also supports this economy that is linear, that is exploitative, and our schools have become subsumed, an extension in a way of the globalizing economy. So there are only a few pockets left in the world that this kind of this economic way of thinking, this colonial way of thinking, has not reached so much, although I think it's very hard to find even indigenous communities that are not affected by this, or are not affected by the consequences of these major earth systems changing. You know, when the reindeer have to forage in different places because the permafrost is melting, or because the weather is so irregular that they can freeze up so that they cannot reach the moss that they eat at the times where they normally could. That shift in the reindeer, and the people, indigenous people working with the reindeer, herding the reindeer, they suffer from that too. And the nanoplastics that you find in even in our bodies, but also in the bodies of species in the oceans far and far away, everything is being affected by this. So then to say, okay, what can we in a way learn from indigenous communities today is, I think, a very good question. I think a lot of it is in the connection with the land and the relations they have with the non-human and the more than human world. At the same time, we must recognize that billions of people live in cities, very urbanized spaces. So the challenge then is, how can we rewild, in a way, the city? And how can we bring possibilities to the city where people, young people inclusive, can connect not just to their devices, you know, which is, we all connect through our devices, our technologies, but through using the senses and really immersing ourselves in the places that we inhabit. If we don't have any connection with the places where we live, who will care for those places? We haven't talked about technology, but I think technology is also something we really need to have a careful look at. How is that affecting young children? And how is our, you know, a lot of parents outsource parenting to the technology, so that they can be on their technology also, which is worrisome, because then the algorithms in the end determine what we do and how we think, which is the opposite of what education wants, you know, autonomous, self-determined, conscientious being who care about themselves and about others. That's not what the technology at the moment is cultivating. It does the opposite. So we need to also really have a conversation about how can we kind of disconnect from the technology, or if we use the technology, since we cannot ban it, it's going to be there. How can we use it to not just to become better consumers and to go back to our screens because some NASDAQ company will make money of that? But how can we use it to connect to each other better, and to nature and the local environment, to engage in monitoring and doing experiments and counting butterflies and having you know, greening the schoolyards and seeing what is the effect and how can we then maybe have network different kindergartens or schools that begin to map kind of the biodiversity in the city together. And then the technology might be a useful support in that.
And this is important because in the discourse of pedagogical innovation, technology almost always comes in. But as you said, it's not always about moving forward.
No.
It's also about how we use the technology that is relevant.
Yeah. And in fact, I would say that's not innovation. That's just strengthening a particular way of thinking that ultimately, when you look at it closely, is destructive. So it's not so much innovation as it is consolidation of something that is existing. So when we talk about innovation, we really need to ask that question, what is it strengthening? What is it silencing? Are we not unwillingly, without being aware of it, are we not consolidating a certain way of thinking, doing, acting, and valuing that in its core is unhealthy and unsustainable?
But this is very important also, and you raised this, that as researchers, we must also be critical of what we are doing, the language that we are supporting, the methods that we are replicating or trying to replicate. Why are we counting and measuring and trying to standardize a lot of things? So this is something that we also have to be very critical of ourselves about. So it's I think it's very important.
Yeah, I sometimes speak about three kind of strands of research, and one I call, also to be provocative a little bit, research as mining, where we as researchers go into communities of children, daycare centers, kindergarten, schools, and we kind of do a study, we observe, we collect data, we analyze the data, and we write a peer-reviewed paper, which is read by very few people, you know, because people don't have time to read. They must produce, they must write papers. So everybody's writing and nobody's reading. Highly unsustainable. And you can also wonder, then you use the school or the kindergarten as a kind of mine where you extract data. And when you have kind of analyzed them, you move on to the next school and the next mine, and you abandon the kind of the children and the teachers and the school leaders, and you move on in your career. That type of research is very much a part of this globalizing system where it's about production efficiency and not so much about meaning or solidarity. So the second strand I call research as co-learning, you know, where we say, okay, we're not learning about the children, we're learning with the children. And we recognize that we have certain knowledge and understanding and wisdom and ways of seeing, but so do the children. And when we interact as researchers, we must be open to their life world and immerse ourselves, get to know them, and they must have some kind of benefit from interacting with us. Research must have a pedagogical end in itself. So that's the co-learning. And then a third one is research as activism. There you say, you know, people suffer. Other species suffer, people are being marginalized, things are happening to people, to the world, that are very unhealthy. And I, as a researcher, have a moral duty to use all my power, all my knowledge, all my wisdom, all my networks to help overcome, fight, support those who are marginalized or colonized. So you take up a more activist role. You're explicitly biased, you might say. You're a sympathetic ally to people's causes. And this does not mean that your research becomes sloppy. You still have to use scientific rigor and good methodologies that fit with that approach, that others can also kind of assessed in terms of is it good work or not. It also means that you focus more on changing practices than and science for impact in society than science for impact factors in journals. And you may have to give up the publishing in journals. And universities need to become bold and courageous, like you were saying, as well, and acknowledging that, no, we need a different kind of research for this earth, this world demands that we do not accelerate unsustainability, but that we start accelerating sustainability. And that requires a different way of looking at what constitutes research in this Anthropocene or Capitalocene.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I think that's a very good summing up of our episode. But if you have some more words that you want to share, we'd be very happy to have them.
Well, you know, maybe to say that, you know, sustainability is often associated with doom and gloom, and it does lead to anxiety. So we need to think about how can sustainability, healthy living, equitable sharing, how can it become attractive? It doesn't have to be doom and gloom. It can be playful, it can be creative, it can be hopeful. Right now, there's this frame of sustainability means we cannot do certain things, we have to do less, and we cannot live our lives anymore. It's the opposite. It leads to more meaningful, fulfilling lives for all, and it can be exciting, and there are lots. It can be kindergartens, can be the beating heart of a community that can show that living together in a more equitable way, in a healthier way, is possible. It can be a microcosm of a sustainable world.
That's awesome. Thank you. Thank you so much for being our first guest. And
thank you for having me.
Yeah, we gained a lot from your wisdom. Thank you, Arjen.
A pleasure.
Du har nå hørt en podcast fra Høgskolen på Vestlandet. For å høre flere podcaster, besøk hvl.no/podcast.